This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. This is Arab English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. I have the honor to be your host for today's episode, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita, and I would love them to introduce themselves.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Asma, and all the listeners. I'm really happy to be here today. I'm Zainab Sadat, and I have my MA in English Language Teaching, TEFL.
So great. And you, Sister Bita?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And actually, I have the pleasure to be here today with you too, my dear friends, and also our dear listeners here. It's a big pleasure for me. So I'm Bita, and I'm a medical student at Sheikh Bashir University. And also, I'm here at your service for today's discussion.
Okay. So there comes some times in our life in which we feel so hopeless and we feel that we've been entrapped and surrounded with too much of disasters, with too much of dilemmas, with too much of problems, that maybe a dark thought like what I'm going to say is going to lurk into your brain and then say that, what about God? What is the role of God in all of these things? Has he really watching over me, or am I just being delusional? Has he been so much hopeless with me that he no longer is going to look at me, to look what is happening to me? Now, I would like you to give me your ideas upon this.
Such a belief could be true in case one loses his or her faith in God. But when God, especially in our precious religion, has called himself the Merciful or Ar-Rahman, you know, believing in God's, you know, departure from our life would be somehow incorrect or wrong. Of course, I accept that. I don't want to be so much
idealistic
or optimistic. I just want to say that even that situation has happened to me. Mm-hmm. We all might have those moments that we believe God has left us alone. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that we should not ignore the fact that God has called himself Ar-Rahman. So he is watching us. He takes care of us. But at that very moment, we should experience the solitude. We should experience the loneliness in order to think about the things that we are supposed to think. Yeah. I think that is the reason.
Sister Bita, yeah. Now I have a question. Let's get it straight from the very beginning. Is it even possible for God to forget us?
At all.
To stop actually, watching us?
Yeah, I wanted to tell you that this is not the problem of, you know, being hopeless in some situations in mm-hmm. this life. It's about being hopeless about what, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, sometimes you are hopeless about the mercifulness of God. This is the problem, you know? You have to understand that no matter how many obstacles you're facing right now in your life, it is not the problem of God or something. It is the way the life it is, actually. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that there are many rules in this life. Mm-hmm. You know, being perfect is impossible, actually, for us, because always there are some defects and problems. But these trying to, and this kind of going through this road to be perfect actually is our goal. You know what? We have to be better. We are here to be a better mm-hmm. human being. And mm-hmm. we are creatures, and the God is the creator.
Yeah.
And this creator knows every single thing about your creation.
Exactly.
You know what? And when you understand the knowledge, the vast knowledge of God, you won't feel like, okay, maybe I'm ignored here. Maybe there is nobody to hear me.
Yeah, that's very much true. So at the very first step, we got to the point that there is no way for this to happen, for the thing that maybe God would forget his creatures, even the bad ones, you know, because we have it in our narrations and even in the Holy Book of Quran. We have this verse, which is very much nice, and every time you go through it, it gives you such a hope, such a motivation to go further, that says that no matter how much sins you have done to yourself, no matter how much injustice you have exposed yourself to, come back to me and I will have you in my arms. So this is very beautiful. This is the Lord that we are talking about. So there's no way for us to think that even for a second, for a half a second, he would leave us on our own. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Back to Reality. In today's episode, we're talking about God being always there for us. And of course, we're going to talk about those dark moments in which this fact is actually the opposite. There are some times in our life in which it is actually out of our control. Sometimes some disasters are the tests of our lives. And exactly in those dilemmas, in those downhills of our life, we feel like we are getting into a hell and there is no way for us to get out. And God seems to be outside our life, which is, of course, not true.
The feeling of loneliness or the feeling of disappointment is not the fault of God. It is some internal feeling that we have. You know, God has just revealed the path of good or bad, wrong or right, and he has advised us to act like this and that. It is up to us whether to take his advice or not.
Yeah.
So when we do not follow his teachings and advices, and we face a problem and we face some difficulties, or no, let's talk about some divine tests.
Yeah.
Tests from Allah.
In the Holy Book of Quran and in our narrations that are given to us by Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, we have it that the greatest sin ever is disappointment from
Allah. Yes, and that is what I wanted to mention. You can see that disappointment is so much dangerous that it is considered as the biggest sin.
Mm-hmm. But believe it or not, it happens to us as human beings.
Yeah,
sometimes we get surrounded with all of these ideas.
You're sitting here, you know, so relaxed, you know, and drinking your coffee or tea or whatever, and you're telling me that, okay, you have to be so faithful whenever it comes, whenever life goes so hard or something. But when it really becomes so hard, you cannot control your thoughts, you cannot control yourself, because this is a part of your nature, you know what I mean? And this disappointment that comes from your difficulties in life is actually something really, really natural, you know? And there is a beautiful thing in Holy Quran that just tells that there are some people in this world that are faithful, but this faith is on the edge, you know? When they are at ease, when they have facilities or something, they say, okay, I pray God, thank God, you know, shukran lillah or something. But when it comes so hard, when life gets somehow more difficult, they are at the age of losing faith. The problem is not this hopelessness. Actually, the problem is what you are hopeless about.
Actually, I guess what sister is trying to say is that even after the torment, the time of the torture that comes to you, after the sickness that suddenly appears to you, after the natural disaster that suddenly take half of your family, after the great test that happens in everyone's life, no matter how far you go, even if it takes a year, even if it takes 10 years of having this thought in you, finally you come to the point where you have to sit with yourself and go through a seclusion from everyone and from the entire world and then tell yourself, okay, he's my Lord. He has always been there and he would always be, because that is his job. He's my creator and he knows every single thing about me. And since we know that, he's even kinder than our mothers. So just imagine how much kindness he keeps towards us. When we sit and we have that chit-chat with ourselves, then we come to a conclusion that, okay, I was wrong and my faith was actually not settled enough in order to keep all the difficulties. But the truth is that he is there and I was the wrong person.
Yeah, exactly.
I was actually following the wrong path. I was not understanding him. So right now, let's put it in here and go for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So we were talking about the fact that sometimes we are enchanted by some ideas that keep hitting in our head and saying that God seems to have been left you on your own and you are going through all these disasters by yourself. Well, we talked about it. You said that sometimes it happens that we are not sitting with ourselves. We're not secluded. We must go through solitude. We must have a chit-chat with ourselves. It happens that maybe we need to get closer to Allah. Now, let's talk about the practical solutions for these moments.
Once I heard it from a university professor that when you meet a difficult situation, you refer to your background noise. Mm-hmm. That was the expression he used. The unconscious knowledge and feeling that you have, and it comes to the surface when you meet a difficult situation and when you have no control over your emotions.
It's more of a temptation that exists in you.
Yes.
You are resisting it, actually, but when you are in a difficult situation, it surges up.
Yes, and it shows itself.
Yeah.
Yes, and even before that incident, you might not even know that you have such a concern. In your mind. It is good to work on our moralities before the disaster happens.
Before the tempest.
When you strengthen your faith in God, mm-hmm. when you talk to your God, when you do all these religious actions, they would come to your help in a rainy day. Not to resist, because that takes lots of energy, you know. You are
But Zainab, that happens unconsciously. You are not doing it.
I know, Asma. You are suffering something really difficult. That fighting against the thing that you cannot handle it, the thing that you cannot control it. I'm talking about this type of difficult situations. In case you can do something, just go and start whatever you are supposed to do. Surrender yourself to the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
As some beautiful ways to actually heal yourself in difficult situations, we heard from Sister Zainab. I want to tell you some more.
Mm-hmm.
Myself, for example, when I actually face some difficult situations, I'm like, okay, this is what happened and life is unpredictable. Okay, I know that I'm so sad and I'm so depressed right now, but I cannot do anything actually. First of all, I accept this disability to do anything in that situation. And this acceptance makes me somehow more relaxed in that situation. And another actually practical way that I use personally in these kind of situations is I just look at myself, look at everything around me. And it's like, okay, I'm only a little part of this world, this universe, and nothing. Actually, I'm nothing, and this really helps me. This thought will help me, like, okay, because you are nothing, you cannot control everything.
Exactly.
I know you're powerful. I know you can handle this. I know this obstacle will pass too, but just don't remember that you are still human, and human is not perfect.
When I get into these quagmires, when I get into these terrible situations, the only one that I am so sure who's going to come to save me is Allah. And I guess having a connection with Allah on a daily basis is a great way of solving pretty much of these issues. When you have a strong connection with Allah, He is going to be there for you always and always. There was this guy who had a terrible situation, and then one night he goes through a dream, and in that dream he sees that God is talking to him and asking him, why you're so sad, why you're so depressed. And then he says, well, because you're leaving me alone, because I'm going through this situation all by myself, and you call yourself kind though you have left me all on myself. Then God answers this way, that He shows him a photo, something that is like the shore of the sea and the sands. And someone's footprint is on the shore of that sea. And then the man says, for sure, these are my footprints and I'm going in there all alone. And then God replies, no, in that dark hour, in those very hardships, I was the one who was carrying you on my shoulder so that you do not get to the very depth of the problem that you felt like you're feeling. We must have a true connection with Him in order to soothe our pain. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amalimi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The United States has entered its last week before the midterm legislative vote, and tensions are starting to escalate. The Republicans appear certain to win the lower House of Representatives and need to win only one of four now neck-and-neck races to also control the upper Senate. Some Democrats have called the polls Republican propaganda, further undermining confidence in their predictions and creating more uncertainty.
I think it should just be positive. It's very hard to decide what is the truth and what isn't. You get the one candidate, and then the next candidate says everything that the first candidate said is wrong on the commercial. We've started muting them.
Perhaps the most telling poll is one which showed that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the country is out of control. Many say there's no lack of reasons for such a perception. The specter of a divided and thus ineffective federal government, record inflation, a prolonged drug epidemic, regular mass shootings, a likely double-dip recession, fear-mongering about war with Russia over Ukraine or with China over Taiwan, a cultural war over identity politics, and more.
Perception is reality, right? So, when we see the political attacks that have happened on both sides, it kind of gives that impression. I think the media can feed into that at times as well. I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of where we're at, unfortunately.
The recent in-home attack on the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who holds the number three post in the American system, has become embroiled in salacious controversy. Similar to the Hunter Biden laptop affair in the autumn of 2020, the case is dominating the pre-vote headlines and producing partisan allegations of either misinformation or a cover-up. Since 2017, the number of investigated threats against Washington's lawmakers has tripled. Perhaps the biggest problem in the United States hasn't even occurred yet, the near certainty of disputed election results. Some tight Senate races may require runoff votes, meaning the final outcome will likely be controversial for weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The UK government has abandoned plans to create a working definition of Islamophobia in a move which has come under heavy fire from critics. Back in May 2019, the then government headed by Theresa May agreed it would seek to establish an Islamophobia definition to get a firmer grip of this bigotry and division. But following mounting frustration over a lack of progress on the issue, the effort has now been reportedly ditched.
The news is hardly surprising, as May's successor, Boris Johnson, has been faulted many times over for saying Islamophobic things, whilst other Tory ministers have also been accused of being deeply Islamophobic themselves.
Reappointed Communities Secretary Michael Gove has been a long-time critic of so-called political Islam, and condemned attempts to define Islamophobia as a danger for free speech.
Michael Gove, while he was at Policy Exchange, was very much supportive of anything which, as far as he was concerned, outed Islam. He calls it political Islam. But actually, in reality, it's a phobia which these folk have about any kind of Muslim. When you look at and compare it to how they deal with anti-Semitism, and they're so absolutely hell-bent on definitions, on laws, on rooting out, on chasing, hunting down, witch-hunting anybody who even sniffs the idea of something to do with Jewry, or even say the J word, or even to raise the issue of Zionism, for instance, or to criticize Israel. As soon as you do these things, as far as these neoconservatives are concerned, you are enemy number one.
Islamophobia is a serious problem across Britain. Muslims being the most frequently targeted group for religious hate crimes in England and Wales. Defining Islamophobia could provide new powers to combat anti-Muslim hate. But with a string of scandals having exposed anti-Muslim bigotry within the ruling party itself, Conservatives just don't seem willing to risk shooting themselves in the foot on the issue. Robert Carter, London.
In a narrow alley in the Itaewon Entertainment District of Seoul, more than 150 people suffocated and died in the crush of a crowd on a Halloween Saturday evening. 26 of them were foreigners. 5 of those were Iranian, the most of any foreign nationals, exchange students in their 20s and 30s. This week, the lives lost in the Itaewon tragedy are being mourned with white chrysanthemums and black ribbons. And as the investigation into what happened begins, tough questions are being asked of the government and of the police about what more could have been done to prevent such a disaster. As video and news of the event has circulated in both mass and social media, frustration at the response of the government and police has swelled.
Our country is not even at war. Whose fault is it for this to happen? Why were they so careless? Where were the police? This tragedy wouldn't have happened if the police had controlled traffic with a little effort. What are you going to do after killing all those young people?
South Korean Prime Minister Han Duck-soo appeared before the foreign press Tuesday. He suggested South Korea was still one of the safest countries in the world and that preparations were inadequate in part because the event was not registered. But he admitted some failures.
The real issue was some deficiencies in our crowd management. That kind of deficiencies in our system should have been corrected long before, but it's a reality that it hasn't been done, and at least we should not pass that away again.
The Itaewon tragedy is South Korea's worst disaster since 2014. When a ferry sank, killing 304 people, most of them students on a field trip. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A group of Iranians, among them war veterans, gathered in front of the German embassy in Tehran to protest against the German government for what they called Berlin's role in the recent riots in Iran. The protesters, including ordinary people and veterans of the 8-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, carried placards and chanted slogans against the German government for its record of supporting former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and its role in the recent unrest in Iran.
A number of my comrades and friends became handicapped and some were martyred in the war because of the enemy's chemical attacks. Documents that have been released reveal that Germany had provided Saddam with raw materials for chemical bombs. Therefore, we are to say that we do not allow Germany to interfere in the internal affairs of our country anymore. We hold Germany responsible for instigating unrest in Iran.
The demonstrators also vented their anger on the German chancellor and foreign minister.
I am taking part in this protest gathering to condemn the German government for its interventionist stance towards Iranian affairs. We know that Germany and other EU member states, by supporting riots and unrest in Iran, are only after their own vested interests, and they do not truly care about Iranian people.
On Monday, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman criticized Germany for its unconstructive initiative to classify the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terrorist organization. Condemning Germany's move as an irresponsible measure, Nasser Kanani said Tehran hopes that the governments of Germany and other governments would take account of the outcome of their unconstructive measures.
Iranian officials believe that repeating such an approach by Germany and other EU member states towards Iran, which is based on miscalculations and misinformation, will once again expose the Union to failure. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan in an attempt to help the two ex-Soviet states settle their long-standing conflict. Putin said he's hopeful that the summit will make it possible to outline steps to resolve the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, adding the Armenian leadership has the political will to resolve the conflict with Azerbaijan. Putin, however, noted Moscow does not impose anything on anyone and only offers a peaceful solution.
I know that you have the political will for this, and we support it in every possible way. We must find the key points that will allow us to move forward. This conflict has been going on for decades, so we still need to end it sometime.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan reacted to Putin's remarks, voicing his readiness to accept Moscow's offer to establish diplomatic relations with Baku. Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev also said that the Karabakh conflict has already become history and it is time to talk about the normalization of relations between Yerevan and Baku. He expressed gratitude to Russia for trying to resolve the issue. Some experts believe the U.S. and some European countries, particularly France, are trying to foment discord between Armenia from Russia, reform their friendly relations to hostility, withdraw Armenia from the CSTO, and encourage Yerevan for a new large-scale military conflict with Azerbaijan.
France is actively intervening in the conflict. NATO's interests are visible behind it. The USA has one of its largest embassies in Yerevan, the same with Azerbaijan. There goes Israel and the UK. The latter is one of Turkey's closest friends. Another block of countries is being formed there, but they all work in the same direction. They are opposed to the participation of Iran and Russia in resolving this conflict and are trying to replace the participation of neighboring states with that of Western ones. This deprives the people of Armenia and Azerbaijan of a peaceful solution.
A six-week war between Azerbaijan and Armenia in 2020, which claimed the lives of more than 6,500 troops on both sides, ended with a Russian brokered deal that saw Yerevan cede swathes of territory that it had controlled for several decades. Last month, 286 people from both sides were killed in the flare-up of new clashes.
Moscow's task is to find ground for compromise. The interference of Turkey, France, Britain and the United States in the Armenian-Azerbaijani relations in recent months, the so-called Western Peace Project may simply threaten the disappearance of Nagorno-Karabakh. Most experts believe the mediation of such countries is a trap from which there is no way out. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A refugee center in Sevastopol, Crimea. Most people here have come from Kherson, a Russian-controlled city now under attack by Ukraine.
I wanted to leave Kherson because it was dangerous there. Ukrainian troops are shooting at civilians. Artillery strikes and rockets are coming from the Ukrainian side. They attack both civilian and military objects. They shell our villages, they destroy our homes and kill children.
She can't hold back the tears.
If there is any connection, I call my friends who are staying in a basement. They tell us stories. A five-story building was shelled and people hear moaning from the rubble. When people tried to rescue them, snipers killed the person who was trying to help and others ran away. Snipers are working everywhere. There was a couple working at the meat factory and the woman was pregnant. The snipers shot both of them in the back. It is Ukraine that does this. The people who remain are considered to be separatists by Ukraine.
Now, many of the people here are scared of Ukrainian reprisals. I've even met an elderly couple here. They're on the Ukrainian kill list, Mirot Verets. Why? Because they're doctors and working in a civilian hospital in Kherson, and they are viewed as Russian collaborators just for doing so.
Roughly 70% of the people in Kherson were pro-Russian and 30% were pro-Ukrainian. The evacuation took place very peacefully and quietly because it came before the military activities began. I have no complaints about the evacuation. The city might be slightly destroyed, but what is more important is that it stays in our hands and victory will be ours.
While pro-Ukrainians may dispute her percentage claim, with Russia forcibly evacuating tens of thousands of civilians from the city, they are now turning it into a fortress, with less risk of either side killing civilians.
Some refugees signed papers to receive financial support. Then they returned 2 weeks later and asked for psychological help. Some people adapt easily, but later they need to talk it out. Some need work immediately, but others need cultural activities to forget the past life and switch to normal life in Sevastopol.
A map in the office. The four regions now claimed by Russia has been colored in with a highlighter. How much more or less will be painted pink will be decided in the coming months, perhaps even years. Meanwhile, it is civilians on both sides of the battle lines who continue to be killed or have their lives turned to turmoil. Johnny Miller, Sevastopol, Crimea.
Importing liquefied natural gas from the US is costing the EU a fortune, and leaders across the 27-nation bloc are looking for a better deal. EU trade ministers met on Monday. They are also not happy with Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. It includes state aid for American manufacturers that will put EU car builders at a disadvantage.
I will be pretty frank. I think in the form how it was presented, I think for the European Union is unacceptable.
This is all happening due to Western sanctions against Russia. Inflation is out of control. We've asked the European Commission why it's not trying to broker peace between Russia and Ukraine.
It just seems to be not on the agenda at all. Am I completely off the mark in that regard?
We have always said that whoever can use its influence to stop the war in Russia and to stop the war in Ukraine, we will support this.
EU trade ministers accuse Russia of using food as a weapon after Moscow left a UN-negotiated deal to facilitate grain shipments from Ukraine. It follows drone attacks on Russia's Black Sea fleet near Sevastopol on Saturday. The Kremlin blames Kiev, helped by British experts. Eurozone inflation has climbed to a new record high of 10.7%. EU leaders are being urged to tackle a growing social crisis in the bloc.
It is in the hand of the decision makers because it is very easy to solve this problem. And it is a shame for the European Union and for the member states.
Many claim the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine by listening to Russia's security concerns surrounding the issue of NATO expansion. Massive public protests are forecast as wages in the EU fail to keep up with soaring inflation. Already here in Belgium, police have agreed to hold a one-day strike on the 9th of November. The country's firefighters have announced they will do the same in December. A date for that has yet to be announced. It's set to be a winter of discontent for EU governments. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
History repeats itself once more in Lebanon as President Michel Aoun steps out of a presidential palace, which will remain vacant for an unknown period of time. Addressing flocks of supporters, Aoun said a chapter has ended in Lebanon's politics and a new chapter will begin.
A new phase begins, and this new phase requires struggle and work to exit our crises. The country is looted, and we have to carry out a lot of efforts to uproot corruption.
Aoun talked about the recent agreement with Israel to demarcate Lebanon's maritime borders. He said the deal secured the nation's access to its natural resources, adding that the future revenues should be used to repair the Lebanese economy.
The demarcation of our maritime border will allow us to extract the national treasure of petrol and gas, which would grant us the needed capital to come out of our economic and financial crisis. We hope to see a sovereign fund that would be used for development and also for the upcoming generations.
Aung took office in 2016. His was marred by mass protests, a severe economic crisis, and currency collapse, and the August 2020 portside blast that killed hundreds. President Michel Aoun ends his term today at a time when Lebanon is deeply divided on various issues, but it was this term that has given Lebanon what experts are calling a golden opportunity to become a gas exporter and salvage its economy. President Aoun does not only leave behind a country without a head of state, but he goes back to his residency. The political divide remains quite entrenched, and experts see that the maritime border deal proves that the West has lifted its undeclared blockade on Lebanon.
In Lebanon, we are not usually good at seizing opportunities, but we benefited from the opportunity of demarcating the maritime border. Since there was a Western interest in having a stability in the Mediterranean region and allowing Lebanon to extract its resources. But will the Lebanese seize this opportunity to form an agreement which could result in the election of a president? We are waiting for the upcoming hours, which could evolve into security threats or perhaps surprises.
Lebanese lawmakers have failed to agree on electing a successor for Aoun, with no side having a clear majority to impose a candidate to succeed him. A caretaker government has been in place since the parliamentary elections last spring, and with no hope in forming a new cabinet in the last hours of Aoun's term, political divisions are expected to deepen until the election of a new president. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
China's Tiangong space station nears completion. Experts say that Tiangong will be the world's second lab in orbit and is set to host more than 1,000 scientific experiments over the next 10 years. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Nature, China's space station Tiangong is almost complete. The third and final module is scheduled to launch into low Earth orbit very soon in the future. The station, only the second lab in orbit, is expected to host more than 1,000 scientific experiments over its lifetime of at least 10 years. These include studying the effects of microgravity on living tissues and the behavior of fires. Building a space station is a massive achievement, says Paolo De Souza, who develops space technologies at Griffith University in the Gold Coast, Australia, adding, "It's outstanding." The space station has opened a new scientific playground for Chinese researchers. Researchers from other countries will also have access to the orbiting lab, says Brad Tucker, an astrophysicist at the Australian National University in Canberra. China has selected 9 international experiments to fly to the outpost through a collaborative project with the United Nations, developed by researchers from Japan, Russia, India, and Mexico, among others. The final module, Mengatian, is one of the 2 modules designed to host scientific experiments. The other, Ventian, was launched in July. Together, Mengatian and Ventian will make up the space station's arms by docking onto the core module, Tianhe, which has been orbiting Earth since April 2021. The Mengatian module is critical to restoring symmetry to the station because it is currently flying along lopsided, which requires a lot of energy to keep oriented, says Jonathan McDowell, an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysicists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Several cargo missions and astronauts have already visited the outpost, and a 3-person crew now lives there. On board are more than 20 mini labs fitted with centrifuges, cold chambers reaching temperatures as low as minus 80 degrees Celsius, a high-temperature furnace, multiple lasers, and an optical atomic clock. These will be used to conduct experiments similar to those carried out on the International Space Station, ISS, including investigations into how long-term confinement in low Earth orbit affects astronauts' health, how to prevent fires on various materials, and the quantum properties of gases. 3 facilities located on the outside of the station will help to study the effects of cosmic radiation on plants and microorganisms. China is not a partner in the ISS, and its astronauts have not been able to access the station. U.S. rules prohibit NASA, a participating agency in the ISS, from engaging in bilateral partnerships with China. A new space lab means researchers can repeat experiments that have been conducted on the ISS to test whether the results can be reproduced, says De Souza, who hopes the findings will be made public. "I am here on the edge of my seat, just waiting for the results," he says. The website of Asia Financial also reported, "More than 25 research projects are already underway, including those to study the effects of microgravity on plant cells, bone, and muscle, as well as on molten materials, together with protein crystallization experiments," says Zhang Wei, a director at the Technology and Engineering Center for Space Utilization, Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing. Chinese state news media also reported that the crew took some 12,000 seeds, including alfalfa, oats, and fungal seeds, to the space station, exposing them to cosmic radiation and microgravity for 6 months before returning them in April to be planted on Earth. Researchers at the Chinese Academy of Sciences have also reported that tail cress and rice seedlings grown in Ventian in late July have started to sprout. Mengjian will take off on a Long March 5B rocket from the Wenchang launch site in southern China. The rocket will probably perform an uncontrolled re-entry into the atmosphere, and several tons of debris could crash somewhere on the Earth's surface, as has happened with previous missions using this type of rocket. Some scientists worry the debris could fall in a populated area. The risk is real, says McDonnell. Fortunately, most of the surface of the Earth is ocean or empty land, so the chance of hitting a heavily populated area is low. Asia Financial also added Tiangong will be the world's second lab in orbit and is set to host more than 1,000 scientific experiments over the next 10 years. The station will be China's first access to a space lab, as its astronauts have not been permitted to use NASA's existing International Space Station, ISS.
Seven, there much pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another program of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the important disciplines that we have within the Islamic corpus of sciences is the study of history. History is very important. Obviously, the study of history, the philosophy of history, how to study history, all of that has its own place. But for example, the glorious Quran mentions history. The stories of the past prophets, alayhim as-salam, is what? Is history. But obviously, the goal is not just to mention history. It's to take lessons from that particular event that occurred in the past. So this is when it regards to the stories of the glorious Quran. But when it comes to Islamic history also, we want to know about, okay, what happened, what occurred. And yes, there are certain things that we can draw lessons from, but that is up to the reader of that particular book, not the writer. The writer is just wanting to write history, then obviously he will just compile a book that has certain events in a chronological manner, starting from, for example, the first year, second year, third year, or for example, you're talking about a person, the first year of this person's life, and so on and so forth. So one of those books within Islamic history, and especially within Shi'i Islamic history, is a book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today. But not the book itself. There is an introduction to that particular book. So therefore, I'm not actually going to mention the whole introduction. You can go read this book and you can find out about this book. I will mention one or two things maybe in the next segment. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear brothers and sisters will be obviously based on the topic of history, but not on history itself. It will be introducing a particular book that was the first or is the oldest known or available book written by a Shi'i scholar on Islamic history. So inshallah, we will introduce this book to our listeners in our next segment, inshallah. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the title of the book that we would like to introduce is called Introduction to Kitab al-Irshad, written by al-Sheikh Muhammad Rida al-Ja'fari. This book, according to the information page, it was translated by WOFUS. Now, WOFUS is a very old organization, a very good organization. One of the first organizations that was created for the spread of Islam in English, known as the World Organization for Islamic Services. So it says it was translated by them as a group and was already published by them as well in the year 2006. Now, also, it must be known that Sheikh Muhammad Rida Ja'fari was one of those scholars who knew English. And from the introduction of the book, it seems that he may have written some of this in English, and obviously this organization is not really translate, but they kind of, maybe assisted with the writing of it. I don't know. It's not clear from the introduction and from the information page. Because Sheikh Muhammad Rida Ja'fari also was that scholar who was responsible for writing the glosses for the translation of Usul al-Kafi that has also been done by this very same institute. Hopefully one day we will introduce that book to our dear listeners, the translation of Al-Kafi by WOFUS. So Sheikh Muhammad Rida Ja'fari, obviously translating or writing in English or writing in a way that maybe was close to English and then this kind of assisted by this organization, wrote an introduction to Kitab al-Irshad. Now, as I mentioned previously or in the previous segment, Kitab al-Irshad is the first or one of the earliest books on history written by a Shia scholar, Sheikh Mufid. Rahmatullah alayh. Sheikh Mufid obviously was a scholar within the second century of the Islamic Hijri, and he was one of the heads of the Hawza of Baghdad. And what is important about this book, and it's also mentioned in the introduction to Kitab al-Irshad itself, which has been translated in English, and hopefully one day we'll be able to introduce it to our dear listeners. It is mentioned that one of the important things about this particular book, Kitab al-Irshad itself, is that it has mentioned certain sources within it, that those sources are no more available to us. We don't have those sources anymore. So this is something important, why this book has historical importance to it. So inshallah, again, the author, Sheikh Muhammad Rida al-Ja'fari, introduces this book to us. For example, the name of the book, the author, certain sects in the Islamic world, certain individuals, the imams, and so on and so forth. So basically, this book introduces that book. So Kitab al-Irshad is a book that deals with the history of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and the imams. Majority of the book being based on the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. This book introducing that book, and then obviously going a little bit more detail in some of the specifics of that book. So inshallah, please stay tuned for our next segment, where we'll be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. With me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we introduce to our dear listeners is titled Introduction to Kitab al-Irshad, that was written by Sheikh Muhammad Rida Ja'fari, rahmatullah alayh, and was published by WOFUS, the World Organization for Islamic Services, which is based in Tehran in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So obviously, as an introduction, it would be good to read the first few pages of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. The name of the book, The title of the book Al-Irshad has been mentioned without any genitive construction in both Al-Fihris of Al-Shaykh al-Tusi and Al-Fihris of Al-Najashi, as well as in the most of the later sources who apparently followed the former two biographical works. This is how Al-Irshad became the famous title for the book. So basically these two books mentioned here of Fihris is a collection of books or a writing down or an index of the books written by Shia scholars and what books they wrote. The one from Sheikh Tusi is the Shia one, and Najashi also Shia. There's the one that was written before of Ibn Nadim. But that's not here, because these are obviously the Shi'i scholars. Sheikh Tusi, obviously we understand that both Sheikh Tusi and Al-Najashi were after Sheikh Al-Mufid, because they obviously saw the book and they wrote that this book existed. However, in many ancient and later references, and also in many manuscript copies of the book, the titles appears in a more complete form as Al-Irshad fi ma'rifat al-hujjat Allah ala al-ibad. The same title also appears in the Ijazah, the permission for narrating the book issued by the famous Imami traditionist Rashiduddin Abu Ja'far Muhammad ibn Ali ibn Shahr Ashub As-Sarrawi al-Mazandarani, who lived between the years 1096 and 1192. For As-Sayyid Muhayyiddin Muhammad ibn Abdullah ibn Ali ibn Zuhra al-Husayni al-Halabi, who passed away in the year 1239, similarly, the full title appears in another ijazah given to Al-Halabi by the famous Shia jurist Al-Sheikh Abu Ja'far Muhammad ibn Idris Al-Hilli. The author, rahmatullah alayh, that is Sheikh Al-Mufid, himself has not described the title in the book, yet the longer title is descriptive of the purpose for which the book was written as mentioned in the author's introduction. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to understand this book, to read this book, to get a better acquaintance of this book in order to better understand the Imams alayhim as-salam. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.